Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, the Middle East is on the brink as tensions reach boiling point. All eyes are on Israel's response to the Iranian attack, but show some restraint, urges Rishi Sunak. Plus, the government's flagship Rwanda bill, groan, returns to the House of Commons today and could be law by Friday, they reckon. We'll bring you all the latest from Westminster tonight. And Labour's deputy leader has vowed to resign if she's found to have committed a criminal offence over her council houses. But Angela Rayner's former aide has already told police she lied about where she was living. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. There's lots to unpick this evening, and we will be discussing it. Liz Truss, remember her? Well, she's released a political memoir of her 44 days in office as Prime Minister and admits she, in quotes, wasn't the best people manager. Actor Steve Coogan calls out water bosses over waste pollution and claims that Lake Windermere is nursing a sewage time bomb. Plus, Octo Plus, a young boy has a surprise when his parents buy him a pet octopus but ends up with more than he bargained for. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Goggles at the ready. Let's dive right in. Now, tensions are flaring in the Middle East after the UK joined the US, France and Jordan in helping to shoot down 300 Iranian rockets fired at Israel over the weekend. Earlier today, Rishi Sunak addressed the House of Commons with accusations that Iran had shown its true colours and that de-escalating the region should be the priority for the Middle East and Western nations alike. Have a look.
Mr. Speaker, with this attack, Iran has once again shown its true colours. They are intent on sowing chaos in their own backyard, on further destabilising the Middle East. Our aim is to support stability and security, because it is right for the region, and because, although the Middle East is thousands of miles away, it has a direct effect on our security and prosperity at home. So we are working urgently with our allies to de-escalate the situation and prevent further bloodshed. We want to see calmer heads prevail, and we are directing all our diplomatic efforts to that end.
Well, with all the latest from that part of the world, let's talk to Talk TV's war correspondent, Tom Much. Tom, a very good evening to you. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. There's a sort of uneasy calm at the moment, isn't there? I mean, Rishi Sunak there talking about calmer heads prevailing. There seems to be an understanding that Israel will not do some kind of knee-jerk response to Iran, but they might wait a while and do something. What are you hearing?
So here's the thing. As I've spoken to Israelis over the last few months, one thing that I have noticed is, I've just got to be frank here, they are wanting war. When I was in the north, they see this as the moment that they really can strike against all their enemies. When I was in the north and I spoke to Israeli soldiers there, they said that they were very eager for a war in the north with Hezbollah. When you speak to people in Israel, even just on the street, or just when texting them, they want a military response to Iran, and they want a large one. Israel really feels that it is under threat from all sides at the moment. And now, one of the things that I think is helpful is the fact that the effort to shoot down the Iranian drones was a multinational effort. It was the US, it was the UK, but I think more importantly, it was Jordan and Saudi Arabia that shot down missiles in their airspace, basically to protect Israel. And hopefully that will send some kind of a signal to the Israelis that they don't need to militarily escalate, because they still have allies in the region that will stand by them against Iran. But yes, it's a really complicated situation.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, though, about the involvement of Saudi and Jordan, because, I mean, a lot of people were saying yesterday that this whole event has made Iran look much more isolated in the world, really, particularly in the Middle East, than ever, because it's very clear that all of the surrounding countries, while they are all Muslim countries surrounding Israel, there's nobody really in cahoots, if you like, with Iran, perhaps apart from Syria.
Yes, but we also have to remember the very powerful Hezbollah militia that is right on Israel's northern border. Now, I was actually in South Lebanon a few weeks ago, and I spoke to people there, and what they told me was that a war between Lebanon or Hezbollah and Israel would be something like a war between Russia and the US. It would be mutually assured destruction. They both have the firepower to do immense, immense damage to the other side. So yes, while Iran may be isolated, it still has that army of very powerful proxies. It has the Syrian government on its side, it has Hezbollah in Lebanon, it has the Houthi rebels in Yemen, and it has various groups in Iraq. Iran has far from shown its full firepower in the region.
Right. And also what's interesting about the whole Hezbollah and Hamas situation is that at the end of the day, this is nothing new, really. You know, 300 drone attacks and cruise missiles and surface-to-air missiles and all the rest of it coming in from Iran is only a slight extrapolation of what goes on every day in Israel. If you live in Israel and you've covered it for many, many years, Tom, you know, there are rockets coming into the country from all sorts of places all the time.
Yes, but this is a little bit different. The rockets that Hamas send, frankly, they're not very powerful and they can be shot down ordinarily. Now, there are specific instances like on October the 7th when they sent a huge barrage, but some of them do get through to Israel and do cause damage. And then there are also the rockets being fired from Hezbollah in the north. Now, actually, though, that had quietened down before October the 7th. And even since October the 7th, the missile strikes from Hezbollah in the north have been limited to particular areas on the Israeli border within more or less 10 kilometers of it. So while that's a very dangerous zone, they haven't been sending them further infield. This, I think, was a much stronger show of force, not just because of the numbers of drones and missiles, but look, we were seeing them being shot down over Jerusalem. We were seeing them being fired into important Israeli military bases. What I think this was, it was a shot across the bow from Iran. Yes, it wasn't designed to annihilate Israel. What it was designed to do is be a show of force and say, look, this is the capabilities we have available. If this situation escalates any further, we can do much more damage. And I think they're probably capable of it.
Yeah, I think so. Tom, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Tom much there for his update from the Middle East. Let's now talk to former British Army officer Colonel Simon Diggins to get his perspective on it. So, Colonel Simon, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Interesting what Tom said there. I mean, Tom, I've got a lot of time before he covers the conflict there in the Middle East for us and has done for since the beginning of it, really. But, I mean, isn't it interesting that even he has almost, by describing it, normalised the fact that people in Israel live in a country which is under constant bombardment one way or another from either Lebanon with Hezbollah or Gaza with Hamas and now Iran firing all these drones and missiles?
No, you're right. There is a sort of sense of what is normal and what is abnormal is different for different people and certainly for the Israelis. That constant sense of threat from different directions sits with them the whole time. And so their reactions are going to be based as much on that rather than specifics of the attack by Iran, and which had, you know, 300 plus drones, missiles, etc. So the judgment of what is an appropriate response is not just that attack, which was thwarted, but also the background of continual threat from them as well.
And do you think that the fact that Israel has not yet retaliated is a kind of confirmation that Benjamin Netanyahu is listening to the West and to his allies who say, you know, let's not get carried away?
He's certainly having to listen to them. I mean, very quickly, I mean, firstly, you've got to say, the Iranians, before the attack had even been finally launched, basically said, as far as they're concerned, the issue is now closed. They were referring to, if you like, the retaliation from the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Whether Netanyahu will, if I take the advice of President Biden, who just said to take the win, or as Tom quite rightly pointed out, people now indicating what an extraordinary situation, what an extraordinary strategic inflection point we've just had. We've had Sunni Muslim states, not just Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Emirates and Omanis, all providing intelligence to a coordinated air defence response to Iran. And that seems to me to be a really important strategic win for Israel. And so I think the equation is, do you go with that, which, if you like, indicates a much wider idea of security in the Middle East, indeed one that was actually starting to come about before October the 7th, or do you deal with, if you like, the shock and revulsion of attack directly onto Israeli soil? And so the test, I think, for Netanyahu is, you know, what sort of leader is he? Can he actually tell his people, actually, we've just achieved something quite extraordinary? It wasn't necessarily just the thwarting of Iran. We've actually got people on our side, including people who in the past have been our opposition or have been somehow unfriendly towards them. And I think that's the real dilemma for him. But then you get into the whole issue about his own internal politics and how that swings around. Right.
Because also there have been many pieces written in the last couple of weeks about how it may well be that Hamas kind of lured Israel into a trap on October the 7th, because they knew that Israel's response would be, you know, in the rest of the world's view, over the top. They knew that Israel would lose sympathy. But now Israel have actually got sympathy back, and perhaps they've got the momentum with their own case at the moment. And maybe he's thinking, let's not make the same mistake twice.
No, I think that's exactly it. I read the article. It was a very good article by Matthew Sayer.
Yeah.
So dope when I wrote sort of the Muhammad Ali analogy, and I thought it was a very good one from there.
Yeah.
As you say, Israel has now rightly recaptured the moral high ground, which the whole world thought that it had after the awful attack on October the 7th. So again, there's a sort of, if you like, strategic incentive in terms of the court of world opinion for Israel to show restraint. The difficulty, I think, that the Netanyahu's got, if that's the way he's going to go, is up until now, the message he's very largely given to the Israeli people is, we will have peace and security in our land, but it's basically by being armed and responsive. And they actually call it double deterrence. So it's not just deterrence against what's happened, but double deterrence. So you hit back at least twice as hard, so you dissuade the opponent from doing something else again. The difficulty now is actually, effectively, he's achieved his deterrence, and the world's on his side. He's got this extraordinary coalition of people willing to protect Israel proper. And will he accept that, or will he still go back for this retaliation with all that kind of escalatory death spiral performance that might involve?
Sure. But I guess the other problem is, if he does nothing, it may well be a signal, if not to Iran, but certainly to Hezbollah, that they should launch another attack. Because I was listening to Bob Seeley, MP, earlier on tonight, saying that they've learned from the Russians on this form of attack, where you send in a lot of very slow drones, which might confuse a missile sort of defence system, and then fire in some other rockets, which could actually cause a lot more damage if they try it again.
No, that's right. I mean, so there will no doubt be elements of what you call it, sort of armed reconnaissance in force, and that could exist. But you know, having restraint doesn't necessarily mean that nothing ever happens at all. And before this series of attacks, the one on the consulate, followed by this counter-response, there's a low-level violence between Israel and Iran through proxies, assassinations, everything goes on. I don't think that's going to stop. I mean, I think what you're basically saying is that this direct state-on-state attack, which has taken place, that's not going to happen again. But I think we will see a continuation of that sort of grey zone warfare, that hybrid form of rockets, missiles, assassinations, and use of proxies that carried on before. I don't think that's necessarily going to stop.
Sure. Simon Diggins, thank you very much indeed. That's Colonel Simon Diggins, of course, on the latest from the Middle East. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, the Rwanda deportation flight could take off in weeks, they say. While ministers scramble at the last minute to find a willing airline, though, and the Rwanda bill ping-pong continues in Parliament. Stay tuned. Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Parliament's return from recess this week means, I'm afraid, the Rwanda bill is now back and it's in the Commons for the final game of ping pong. The plan to send asylum seekers to the African nation has faced multiple setbacks since it was first announced in, believe it or not, April 2022. Before the Easter break, the House of Lords passed a second set of seven amendments and returned the bill to the Commons. Now, the Sun's Deputy Political Editor, Ryan Sabey, is live in the House of Commons for us right now in Westminster. Ryan, very good evening to you. Thanks for joining us. What's going on and how exciting is it?
I mean, we're nearly there. We're nearly there, this legislation being passed after... as you say, it seems a long time ago now when Priti Patel went out to Rwanda to sign that deal. She was Home Secretary. It feels like we've had several Home Secretaries since then. But now the legislation is in the House of Commons. They'll be voting down those House of Lords amendments this evening. There's seven there at the moment. It will go back to the House of Lords, and we may expect some ping-pong when the legislation alternates between the two houses. We may expect one more round of that. So we expect the legislation to be passed finally by the end of the week, but expect a tiny, tiny little bit of resistance from the House of Lords tomorrow.
Right. So the voting is going on as we speak, is it?
Well, they're currently debating the legislation right now, and there'll be votes somewhere around 9 o'clock tonight. So we expect all of those amendments to be voted down, and for the legislation literally to pass from the House of Commons just to my left to the House of Lords to my right. The legislation will physically be passed down and ready for tomorrow night, where the House of Lords have got that decision whether to add a few more amendments to the legislation.
Right. And just to complicate matters, I see that they've now thrown a few other countries into the mix, to wit, Costa Rica, Botswana, the Ivory Coast and Armenia. So, I mean, the Home Office is kind of operating a bit like travel agents now, is it?
Yeah, no, exactly. They've been speaking to all these countries, and some of them are actually tapped up, so to speak, at the King's coronation sort of last year. So Rishi Sunak was working his diplomatic magic at the time where King Charles was being crowned. And, and it seems like some of that work may have actually paid off, with Costa Rica in particular looking like a favourite to be added to that list. But it seems like that would be a long way off. And don't forget, if you have that general election this year, Labour said they will get rid of the Rwanda policy. So, I think whether we add any more countries to that is pretty much up in the air at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ryan, listen, I appreciate your patience, and you must be as glad as I am that it's nearly over. We can actually start talking about something else, but we shall see. Ryan Sabey from The Sun there. Thank you very much indeed. Time now to bring in the panel. I've got journalist at The Telegraph, Madeline Grant, here. She's here as well. Laura Dodsworth, broadcaster. Broadcaster and barrister Andrew Eagle. Very good evening to all of you. We always think, don't we? You always get this ridiculous thing now, right? Which completely puts everybody off. Anyway, they love it in the gallery. Good evening.
You're just jealous, Mike.
I am. I don't even have one. I don't have a sting when I say my name.
It's like a 5-minute preamble
exactly.
With various cartoons of you jumping out.
That's true.
Yeah.
I know. But listen, what can I say? I don't know. It seems to me that we've been talking about this thing for ages. Mm. 2022, gosh, 2 years ago. So it just seems bizarre, doesn't it, that we're now talking about other countries being brought into the mix. I mean, what's the point?
Well, there's no point. I mean, the other countries, that's just, as Ryan pointed out, this is all for the birds. Rwanda, the difficulty and the expense that has gone into this scheme, the fact that of the amount that has been already spent attempting to bring this about, only a tiny fraction of that money has actually been towards the blocks and the potential settlements for refugees. The rest of it has gone directly into the coffers of the Rwandan government, who, have played a blinder.
They have done.
Frankly.
Yeah. They've now got loads of nice new accommodation, which they're giving to their own people.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
But 2 years. 2 years. I mean, how many toothbrushes has an ordinary person got through the time that it's taken?
Right.
They've had two pregnancies in that time.
Oh.
Yeah, but, the thing is, there is a symbolic value in this tonight. The safety of Rwanda bill isn't just about the safety of a third country to take illegal immigrants. It's about the safety of British democracy.
Yeah. Mm.
I don't think there's any doubt that the will of the British people is that the government gets immigration and uncontrolled immigration, illegal immigration, under control. I mean, how many small boat crossings are we on so far?
But it's out of control. It was another record. 7,000? It was a record on Sunday.
That's right. But the thing is, you know, the will of the British people and our elected government shouldn't be constantly thwarted by an unelected establishment. So, you know, whatever you think of the Rwanda bill, whether other countries involved or not, whether you think this is really going to work as a deterrent and create a hostile environment or not, the fact is it's about enacting the will of the British people and democracy. And so I think it's. I think tonight could be an important symbolic.
Maybe. But we've taken an awfully long time to get to a place where nothing still has happened. You know, it's a bit like waiting. It's like waiting for a train, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed. And finally, when it comes, it's not a train, it's a bus.
Yes.
And it's going to take ages to get where you want to go.
As I say, the ping pong is more pong than ping, I think, in this thing. I love the fact, as Ryan said, it's all up in the air. Well, unlike the flights, I mean, the reality is they will get it through. They will get some people off to Rwanda. I like the fact that Costa Rica cost a fortune. That will probably happen.
Yeah, well, don't worry, there's more. I find it a bit shabby as well, don't you, that people were being sort of tapped up at the coronation by Rishi Sunak.
I don't know.
Excuse me.
It was ever thus, I think.
Well, I suppose so, but it seems a bit shabby to be getting.
It does seem
mind awfully. You know,
the real focus.
Would you stop talking when I'm talking?
Oh, sorry.
You know, it doesn't work like that. You can talk when I've finished talking. You know, here's a vol-au-vent. Would you mind taking some refugees for us?
Yeah.
It seems a bit odd, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does seem odd.
Isn't it partly the point of the royal family that their parties and gigs enable this kind of political diplomacy? It's part of the point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, in this case,
a funeral should be a place where very high-level meetings would take place, and it was considered a massive diplomatic coup to have been invited onto the royal yacht.
Yes.
I think we do underestimate these things.
No, sometimes. I mean, I'm sure that there can be questions asked and put, but, I mean, if you're actually asking people to take human beings into their country on your behalf because you don't know what else to do with them, it seems a little bit kind of manky to me, if you don't mind me saying so.
It does seem manky.
We've got to have a deterrent. I mean, if you've lost control of your borders, you have nothing. And I think
Laura
is absolutely right. You know, we can laugh about how long this has taken, but part of the reason this is been such a logistical nightmare is because, you know, it has faced deep opposition from within our institutions.
Yes, and still
and
does.
And almost getting any sort of border policy established would meet with fierce opposition. And isn't that a problem?
Yes, it is.
Everything is thwarted like this.
But it is, but that's why, and I'm going to let Andrew speak now, so I feel
thank you.
No, but the thing is, you know, we've spent all this time, and both of you are right to say that we need to do it, but it will still, in my view, result in nothing at all. Because if you get any single person onto a plane, there'll be a phalanx of lawyers to get them off.
Well, I think the reality is this, is that it's the wrong focus, as always. The focus has to be on the abhorrent people traffickers and looking at that sort of point. And whilst it might be one of Rishi's 5 points, we will get some people, stop the boats. They will get some people going to Rwanda. At least that will be some sort of victory. But they can only process 200 people, and that's the reality.
Yeah.
So they need to look at Costa Rica and these other places they're going to do it. But actually change the focus, change the record, and it should be look at the people traffickers. Let's stop that abhorrent
trade. It's much bigger than that. There was a fantastic article in The Telegraph this week by Sam Ashworth-Hayes about all of the problems actually in enforcing our immigration policy and the fact that so many people who don't have leave to remain, you know, their deportation isn't enforced. And when it comes to tribunal, something like, well, I think over 10% of tribunals aren't even attended by a Home Office representative to argue their case.
Yeah.
We're just letting people in and then not deporting them when their time runs out. And the longer they stay, the more likely they are to find Jesus or whatever, or get married, or need NHS care.
And then
you can't ever deport them.
But that's the incentive for them to come, because they know if they put their feet on the ground in Dover, they're never going to leave. Because at the end of the day, when people say, oh, but 75% of them get asylum in the end, that means they must be genuine asylum seekers. No, they get it just because they've been here so long.
I really think that there's a massive problem of accountability with the Home Office.
Yeah.
You know, the politicians bear a great deal of the blame, and I would argue, you know, that much of that is justified. But I remember there was a Home Office Select Committee recently where two of the most powerful mandarins in the country couldn't divulge the most basic data about their own brief. And I think this is something that, I don't know, I think we may find that with a change of government, the same problems remain and we have even less will at the top to get this done.
Mm.
And we need to have a conversation about what's going on in the institutions as well.
It's very clear that the Home Office has not been doing its job for at least 10 years, possibly longer, since Labour was in fact, when John Reid said they were not fit for purpose. They haven't got any better. They've actually got worse, haven't they?
Yeah, and that's why schemes like the Safety of Rwanda Bill come to pass, because there is so much resistance in civil service and in the unelected establishment to deal with this problem of uncontrolled immigration. That's why, I think we do need this symbolic win.
Right. It really might be a symbolic win, but symbolic isn't really going to do anything because we're also hearing at the same time this week that Serco and others, the contractors that the government has given £4 billion to, by the way, are now commandeering homes in places like Hull, Middlesbrough, Bradford, and basically putting migrants in there because they reckon it's cheaper than paying 150 quid a night to get them into a hotel.
Yeah.
So the problem persists and actually is going to get worse, isn't it?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, and that's the reality. We need to put those sort of figures in perspective.
Right.
And also, I mean, there has to be a win before the election. The win will just be... But it's a symbolic one. We've been talking about it far too long with no results. So it's going to be a sort of Pyrrhic victory, I think, by the time eventually happens.
If that.
But that example you give is a really important one because it tells you something about the mentality within government and within the civil service, perhaps too, where they've been told there is a problem. People are very unhappy about the amount of money that's being spent on hotels. How do they fix the problem? Send people away from hotels and into private sector accommodation.
But still pay for
them. There are some people in government who might chalk that up as a win.
Right.
You know, that there's the kind of the sheer ignorance about. Well, it's almost like we're constantly papering over cracks and never getting to the number of things.
Exactly. Because there's 1.3 million people, I think, to date, waiting for social housing, waiting for council housing of one kind or another. And that's all now being eaten into by migrant housing because that's the only stuff they can give them. And the other question I would have about these countries that we're approaching, you know, with Rwanda, we've already agreed that we would take people from Rwanda to come and live here. So presumably Cape Verde, Senegal, Tanzania, Togo, Angola, Sierra Leone, all these African countries that we're talking to, are we giving them carte blanche to send people to our country while they take some of our refugees? I don't know.
Yeah. And that'll be part of it. And it's all about, and as I say, it's a slight diversion, isn't it? It's not just about the boats. If you look at the actual migration figures and the net migration figures, we also need certain people for certain industries and jobs for care homes and so on and so forth. So there needs to be the positive side of that. But we need to look at it as a whole.
Well, yeah, but the positive side, unfortunately, of that is that they come and then they stay and then they bring families with them and they end up being a net drain on society.
Well,
because,
trying to
stop they've
that
got five
bit.
People it's coming and one person working.
It's everything in immigration policy
buggered.
Goes back to short-termism and papering over cracks.
Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
And also making a decision that maybe seems cheaper in the short term, but in the long run costs the public an awful lot more.
Yeah.
You know, rather than paying more to care workers and not incurring those long-term liabilities of you know, the welfare state.
And the whole thing is just knackered, it seems to me.
It's completely and utterly
knackered.
It's another good result that we might leave the ECHR, though.
Well, that might happen as well. But there's a lot of Pyrrhic victories going on. Meanwhile, we've still got crumbling towns, people in places, too many of them, no services to help them out. It's absolutely ridiculous. I know you guys want to talk about the Iran situation as well. We'll get to that coming up. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, Sir Keir Starmer is nowhere to be seen after Yvette Cooper's terrible justification for Two Homes Rainer, as she's now known, and the bizarre premiership of Liz Truss under the microscope. Stay right there. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer stands accused of deliberately avoiding dealing with the row over Angela Rayner's two houses, but pressure's mounting and the public want him to show some kind of leadership over the whole matter. Back with me are Madeline and Laura. I'd also like to welcome Rafe Heidel-Mancu, historian and broadcaster. Angela Rayner, the story that will not go away, no matter how hard the BBC tries to snuff it out. You see Laura Kunzberg on Sunday having to defend the BBC for covering the story because that guy from the author, whose name escapes me, John O, somebody or other, was having a go saying, you don't have to do this story just because the Daily Mail says it's a story. You know, and so she had to sort of defend it. Meanwhile,
did
we found...
They got a snippet about it taken out of Newsnight.
Well, I was about to tell you about that. Yes.
Sorry.
No, I was about to mention it. Nick Watt apparently admitted to editing an interview because he compared her situation to Beergate. And they've admitted editing it because the Labour Party asked them to take it out.
Astonishing.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's at this time when it looks as if a change of government is imminent, that's the point at which the journalists become somewhat more toadying towards the incoming
party. Yeah, I never understood that.
Well, it means maybe their contacts book will be a bit better when Labour are in charge, but I still think people can sense
it. See, I've always believed it's far better not to be too close with these people. I know if you work in Parliament, you sort of have to play the game.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as a journalist, I've always thought, I don't want to be particularly friends with politicians, you know, because I want to be able to have a go at them. And if you become friends with them, it's much more difficult.
And also, they'll give you the nuggets.
Unless you're a psychopath.
But they'll give you nuggets that they want you to have.
Right.
You know, so you become more of a kind of spinner.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. We'll talk about Liz Truss in a minute. But Angela Rayner has now eventually come out and actually said, well, of course, if they find that I've done something wrong and I've committed a crime, then I will resign. Presumably she's already been advised that she hasn't committed a crime, otherwise she would never have said that, would she?
Why does she just release her tax advice? Wouldn't that be the simplest solution? Just get on with it. Release the official tax advice if she had it.
Right. I don't think she had it. I don't think she did anything terribly wrong. However, it's what's happened since what she did that has been a problem. Because what you'll end up basically doing here is covering it all up. And that's what seems to be the issue.
But it's also the stench of hypocrisy that now surrounds her. Because, you know, she was the one demanding that Boris Johnson resign when the investigation had just started before there was any findings for all of that. She was the one who was so strict.
Just the investigation alone.
She's been the one who was so strict with you know, other people in the Conservative Party about their tax returns too. And when you have Keir Starmer pitching his tent on cleaning up public standards, restricting the right to buy council houses, and cracking down on tax dodgers, and then your deputy leader falls foul of potentially all three of those.
Right.
I mean, I think you need to actually have a time. I mean, if you were the British public, you would think this is the time for Keir Starmer to show us his leadership abilities.
Right.
But he's riding two horses. Yes, one as premier in waiting, but also as leader of the Labour Party, he has to keep that broad church together, which is already fraying in so many ways.
Right.
And I think he wants to avoid any chance of having a Jeremy Corbyn versus Tom Watson situation.
Yes.
When Tom Watson was deputy leader, they had a very fractious relationship.
Right.
He's hoping more for a John Prescott-Blair relationship, perhaps. Mm. And I think that's why he's having to actually, you know, play this, well, avoid dealing with the facts as they are.
Yeah. I mean, there are some who think that Starmer doesn't really like Angela Rayner and is quite happy to sort of let her be sort of chewed at bit by bit by the pack of wolves outside while pretending that he's kind of protecting her by not looking at the legal advice so that he can say later, well, I wasn't exactly sure what it was anyway.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, of course, he did once try to sack her and it backfired horribly. Yeah. And
he couldn't even manage that.
More job titles than he had at the beginning. I mean, I think that might be true, but it does tell you something about... There's a sort of real arrogance, I think, in Labour's approach. They obviously think that they're riding so high in the polls that they're in such an unassailable position that they can just ride it out, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know...
But
that's
not a very good sign, is it, if they are an incoming government and they think that they can just ignore the press?
And I think, press. You know, they always make so much of Starmer and his forensic legal brain and his attention to detail, and he hasn't bothered to read the legal advice, although he says that members of his team have seen it. However, this story has now been chugging along for over a month, maybe since February, I think.
I mean, you can't believe, can you, that Starmer's sitting in his office and at no time has anybody ever had a conversation with him about Angela Rayner's tax affairs.
And, you know, as Laura said, they could have made this all go away by now, but they haven't. They've tried to ride it out and perhaps it will be successful. I mean, you know, if it come, the police say that there was nothing untoward here, nothing serious enough to warrant further action, then they'll probably say, oh, look, ha-ha, this wasn't a story at all.
Right.
It was just confected nonsense by the Tories, but it does give us an insight into their attitude.
Yes.
There's another aspect to this which doesn't sit well with me. I'm not quite so right-leaning as some people think I am. I really believe in social housing and I think it should remain social housing.
Mm.
So even if she didn't do anything wrong and followed her tax advice, I just don't think socialists should be buying social housing.
No.
It should remain social housing.
All property is theft to them, isn't it? Surely.
Well, they hate Mrs. Thatcher, don't they?
Yeah, they hated the fact that you could buy your own council house.
You have helped to buy schemes,
right?
And then social housing should remain social housing. It shouldn't be bought so you can profit on it. This is a problem we have right now, that we don't have enough social housing for people who can't afford to get on the property ladder. So I find there's something to be just fundamentally money-grabbing about the whole thing anyway.
Absolutely, and she is also Shadow Minister for Housing, isn't she?
Mm.
Which is also complicating. And she also wants to do away with the Help to Buy scheme, which gives you the right to buy the property for less money at a discounted rate so that you can make even more profit. She wants to do away with that, even though that's what apparently she did. Again, I don't care what she did, but I do care about the way she's covering it up. And it also betrays, I think, the champagne socialist nature of the Labour Party, because they keep saying to everybody, well, you know, look at the Tories. They've been rinsing us for millions and not paying tax. This is only 1,500 quid. Well, 1,500 quid is quite a lot of money to quite a lot of people. In places like where she bought that house in Stockport, you know?
But it's the principle of the issue, isn't it? The amount of money is irrelevant. It's the principle of the
issue. Yeah, the amount
when you
is
make
not
your stand on public standards. And again, the principle is, of course, that this is a woman who has campaigned against restricting the right to buy, and yet she's benefited from that again. So on both levels, it's about principle. I think she's also shadow minister for levelling up.
Yeah.
So, you know, Keir Starmer
she's
can't
to level
do
up her own
about
bank
it.
Account.
The deputy leader is elected by the members, right? So there's nothing that Keir Starmer can do about her being deputy leader.
Right.
But he can withdraw those portfolios from her, should he wish.
Yes.
But even that he hasn't sort of...
Although, done. As Madeleine says, every time he tries to do that, she ends up with even more jobs. Let's talk about Liz Truss. I'll show you a little clip of an interview she did with The Sun's Harry Cole. Have a look.
You know more than anyone that trying to, I was going to use a ruder word there, but I'll say mess with things like the OBR and the sort of normal way of doing things,
the status quo
ends in tears pretty quickly. So,
well, it did end in tears for me. What? That's certainly true. By the way, and just on this, you know, I am constantly getting trashed in the left-wing media, obviously not in the Sun, but in the left-wing media, about... you know, my failings, and I totally admit that I've got failings, but what scrutiny is Andrew Bailey being placed under about his role in this? What scrutiny is he being placed under about the LDI scandal, which he presided over? And they are, you know, this guy is paid twice as much as a prime minister, much harder to sack than a prime minister, and yet the media put very little scrutiny on him.
That interview in full can be seen online on The Sun's website. I think she's probably got a point about Andrew Bailey, but it's kind of a curious situation that Liz Truss finds herself in now. She's tried to form this PopCon organisation, which is supposed to be a sort of grassroots conservative movement, which doesn't appear to have got very far since she launched it. I was looking on their Twitter account, they've only got 1.8 thousand followers, which is not going to be a government anytime soon. And somebody, Stig Abel from Times Radio, who's not somebody I normally agree with, put out a tweet today who said that she actually suffers from whatever the exact opposite of imposter syndrome is, which I thought was quite interesting, because she's absolutely convinced that she was right and everybody else was wrong, isn't she?
She's as deluded as she is disingenuous. And I think, no, I'm quite serious about it, yeah. And the fact that, you know, the fact that somebody of such limited abilities, you know, completely devoid of charisma, could get voted in by the Tory party membership. I mean, the Tory party must radically change how they select their leaders,
yeah.
Because we can't. It's a completely broken process to end up with somebody who is so incompetent as Liz Truss.
But she still managed
but
to beat Rishi Sunak.
Rate.
But she
they're
beat
the
Rishi Sunak.
They're the Tory party members, and they voted.
Yeah, but this woman doesn't have a conservative bone in
to
her
be
body.
Fair, it was the Tory party MPs who made it so that it was a choice between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. I mean, I think if the members had their way, it would have been either Penny Mordaunt or Kemi Badenoch.
Yeah.
I think even Tom Tugendhat, right. These were probably the last two people that they would have wanted. I'm not saying that, obviously, they made a terrible decision, but, you know...
But the choice wasn't great.
Exactly.
No, you're right. I mean, it's a bit like whatever the choice is going to be for President of the United States of America.
Yeah.
Some people say, could we not get a slightly better choice? But similarly...
No, but Rafe is right. I mean, the paucity of talent across politics in general is depressing and a huge problem. And I also think... we're in for a rude awakening when it comes to the Labour Party.
No, I
have to spend all day watching them. So basically anyone halfway competent has already been put on the Labour front bench. They're going to have a whole range of jobs now that they have to find decent people for. And if you look at Michael Crick, who follows very carefully the people who are being selected, you know, there's often people who've not really had great responsibilities before entering Parliament, mostly like people who've been a local councillor or something, or they've had a job that, although important, might not confer real responsibility. And I wonder where the next front bench is going to come from. So it is a real problem.
Well, this is it. And we've got to finish it here. But I read a story today which actually said that there are some people, I don't presume they're not in the Labour Party, saying that David Cameron should stay on as Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, even if Labour wins the next election. I'm going, sorry? Anyway.
Sure, David Lammy would love that.
And we'll come back to that. We'll come back to more of you guys as well. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Residents are furious as the Home Office tries to buy up British homes to house hotel migrants. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now it's time for Taking the Mic. Welcome to yet another day and yet another promise on immigration. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, what do we have for you this time, I hear you ask? Well, aside from the standing promise to remove people to Rwanda, we have an entire smorgasbord of places you can go. If you don't fancy Kigali this summer, Rishi could let you opt out for a different destination. So, how about Armenia or the Ivory Coast or Costa Rica or Botswana? And if you don't fancy any of those, we can offer you Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru or Colombia. Brazil might be a little harder, but it's not off the agenda just yet. And it doesn't stop in South America either. The list of destinations also includes Cape Verde, Senegal, Tanzania, Togo, Angola, Sierra Leone, Morocco, Tunisia, Namibia and the Gambia. Believe it or not, the government has been in talks with all these countries and more in the past few months. The Home Office is fast becoming more of a travel agent than it is a place where immigration controls are actually enforced. But the sheer numbers of illegal migrants already here is overwhelming any system that they try to put in to remove any of them. Only this Sunday, there was a new one-day record of 534 illegal migrants crossing the channel to get here. Over 2 days of the weekend, the number rose to 748. The numbers arriving are still outweighing those leaving by hundreds every single day. And that's despite hundreds of millions of pounds being paid to France to police their shores better, and more hundreds of millions of pounds being paid to Rwanda to take more illegal migrants into their country. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has already promised to stop housing them in hotels, but then he's also promised to stop the boats, and neither of those promises shows any sign of coming true. But there are already problems in towns around the country where government contractors like Serco are buying up more and more properties to house migrants they want to move out of the hotels, where it can cost as much as £150 a night per migrant. Private houses will cost more like £30 a night, and the Home Office has already secured 16,000 rental properties in places like Hull, Bradford and Middlesbrough. But locals who are waiting for social housing are up in arms, as are homeless groups who have been asking for homes for years. Many fear that simply moving dozens of illegal migrants into poorer areas of the country will create ghettos with the inevitable problems that brings. The Home Office has already lost track of over 6,000 illegals who are now roaming the country. Serco, along with fellow contractors Clear Springs and Mears, are offering landlords five-year leases with rents paid in full, on time, every month with no arrears, as well as full repairs and maintenance included. It's an offer that many are finding too good to turn down, and it's costing us, the taxpayer, around £4 billion. Meanwhile, there are about 1.3 million people on council house waiting lists that get longer each month. It's yet another government-inspired recipe for disaster. Ghettos are no solution to increasingly failing social cohesion, and I'm afraid things can only get worse. Now, we've been following the disgraceful state of our sewage-polluted waterways closely on this programme over the last few months, and while supporting the Save Windermere campaign in their strike against sewage this morning was comedian Steve Coogan, who warns that United Utilities is creating what he calls a sewage time bomb in England's largest natural lake. The founder of the Save Windermere campaign, zoologist Matt Staniak, joins me now. Matt, very good evening to you. I know you've been on something of a sleep strike, so you're probably struggling to keep your eyes open. I'll try and make sure I don't bore you to death and make you go to sleep. Tell us about Steve Coogan today and what he did for you.
Yeah, so Steve came and, you know, added his voice to align with our message, which is very simple. You know, it's stop putting sewage into Lake Windermere. And what he came to join was the 24th week of our strike against sewage, in which we sit outside of United Utilities greenwashing centre in the centre of Windermere. And it kind of came to me that the 24th week marks a whole day of my life that's been spent so far outside of the United Utilities Centre, because we usually strike from 9 a.m. on a Monday morning till 10 o'clock. So to celebrate that you know milestone, we decided to sit outside of the centre for 24 hours straight. So yeah, I've little sleep in the last 24 hours, but you know it did its job. Windermere is now once again back up on the national stage, and we're pushing a very simple message, which is stop the sewage.
Yeah. And it's been pretty awful weather today. It's weather warnings all over the place. I don't know what it's been like where you are in Windermere, but if it's raining heavily there, I imagine the pollution will be pretty bad in the lake.
Yeah, no, it was incredibly wet last night. And, you know, you have those moments of, well, that is the reality to it, that we have not seen the investment to deal with rainfall in the Lake District. And you've also got the complete failure of regulation, which they are allowing sewage to be dumped. This is the Environment Agency. They're allowing sewage to be dumped in the Lake District National Park at 0.25 millimetres of rainfall. You know, the law is very, very clear. It's supposed to happen in exceptional circumstances. And, you know, you have these moments where I'm sat outside a United Utilities Centre. It's absolutely lashing down with rain. And, you know, there's a fairly good likelihood that they were spilling as a result of it. And that really encompasses what the campaign is about. We need to stop putting sewage into Windermere.
And we spoke to you, I think it was only last week. I mean, has anything changed in the response that you're getting from the organisation themselves, you know, the United Utilities people? Are they showing any signs of sympathy with you?
No, not realistically. You know, they were interviewed on Good Morning Britain this morning, and it, so much of it is just a smokescreen. It's trying to distract us away from the issue. They say things like, you know, we've invested X amount of millions of pounds into Windermere and none of it is good enough. And particularly when you look at this level of investment in comparison to how much they are sending to their shareholders in the form of dividends. You know, last year alone, they sent over £450 million to their shareholders. Their ex-chief executive, Steve Mogford, he was in his post for 12 years. He took away £30 million. You know, what they're investing in Windermere is an absolute drop in the ocean. And like I was saying earlier, this is being allowed by the regulation, both Ofwat and the Environment Agency. And as a result of it, profit is being prioritised over the ecological integrity of Lake Windermere, which is England's largest lake and the jewel in the crown of the national park. And if this is happening to Lake Windermere, then this is absolutely happening to your river, to your coastline, to your lake. And as a result of it, the bill payer is paying for this.
Absolutely right. And as far as Steve Coogan's words, you know, a sewage time bomb that he said was going to be the case, what does he mean by that? What is he alluding to?
So it's one of the big problems that we face with Windermere in that we've not just got what is going into the system. You know, as a statistic, since 2020, United Utilities has discharged over 27,700 hours of untreated sewage into Windermere and its surrounding rivers. But one of the big problems that we face is the damage that has already been done, because Windermere is essentially an enclosed ecosystem because it's a lake.
Yeah.
So much of what you put into a lake gets trapped within that lake itself. So we have a latent layer of pollution at the bed of Windermere, which is incredibly high in the nutrient, which is basically a fertilizer for algae. When you get natural circumstances where the lower levels of the lake become anoxic or the lower levels reduce in oxygen, that can release that trapped nutrient. So you could have a system where you have a drought period in which you've got lots of people coming to the national park, putting pressure on inadequate infrastructure. That then feeds the algae. When the algae dies and sinks to the bed of the lake and starts to decompose, that process uses oxygen. It can then release what is trapped within the sediment itself. And you've got almost like a positive feedback loop where the algae just cycles through, gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And when you get these extensive algal blooms, you can see mass fish kills as a result of it. Mm. As an example, Mar Menor in Spain, it's a saltwater lagoon. And in 3 years recently, you know, like 20, I can't remember the exact dates, it's like 2019, 2020, 2021, yeah. They saw mass fish kills because they had massive algal blooms.
I've got to stop you, Matt. Sorry about that. Well, I know you're sleep deprived. We're time deprived, I'm afraid. I'm time deprived. We've got to go. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We'll talk more about that coming up. The Trump trade storms back to New York as his alleged hush money trial begins amidst claims that this is all to hurt his presidential chances. He says it's all lawfare. Back after this.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, you're on radio, online, and of course on your smart speaker. Coming up in this hour, Donald Trump makes history as the first American president to ever stand trial on criminal charges, with over 34 counts of fraud in relation to alleged hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. But should new drivers be banned from giving lifts? The AA wants to stop young drivers taking passengers, saying it could save lives. And Markle family drama as the Duchess's brother parodies her in a series of YouTube videos whilst wearing a wig and a tiara. Blimey. But first, it's not been a great week for the electric car business, I'm afraid, and it's only Monday. First up, Elon Musk announced he'd be laying off 14,000 people at Tesla. That's 10% of the global workforce, thanks to a decline in car deliveries in the first quarter of 2024, for the first time in 4 years. I've been predicting the downturn of the electric car business for the past several months as I've watched sales figures plummet and doubts cast on the life of batteries and a lack of understanding about the actual environmental effects they have on the world. But of course, every time I've done it, the wokists deny there's a problem and keep making promises they can't keep. Now it seems I've been proved right yet again. Tesla blamed the slow sales and a drop in demand for electric vehicles, an arson attack on its planned new factory near Berlin, and supply chain issues thanks to the conflict in the Red Sea. But Musk is a clever guy, and there's clearly something else going on as well. Yesterday, he wrote a letter to his employees in which he said, "There is nothing I hate more, but it must be done. This will enable us to be lean, innovative, and hungry for the next phase cycle." Now, could it be that he's realised he can't take the Tesla any further? Of course, it's bad news for virtue-signalling drivers everywhere and also for the shareholders, but it's not the end of the story. Tesla is also going to shorten the production shifts at Cybertruck too, at the Gigafactory in Texas, after disappointing sales of that strange-looking futuristic vehicle. On top of all that, BP has similarly cut over a tenth of its workforce in the electric charging business they run, once again because of disappointing sales of the cars. The oil company bet that commercial electric vehicle fleet sales would be booming by now, but they're not. And if anything, sales are switching back to petrol and hybrid vehicles instead. Cheap Chinese imports are coming, as I told you last year, and they will flood the European market in the next few months. They are subject to large tariffs and taxes in the USA, but not here. Other signs that the electric revolution is over include the fact that today, US private equity investors have bought land near Blyth in Northumberland, which was originally earmarked as the first electric car battery gigafactory. It was expected to be the home of a £3.8 billion British Volt place, but the firm fell into administration last year with a loss of more than 200 jobs. Then an Australian outfit, which was due to step in, also went bust and was wound up. Now Northumberland County Council say the land has been sold to Blackstone with a view to turning the site into a data centre supplying 4,300 jobs. Great news for Northumberland, but not so great news for the electric car business. See you at the petrol pumps. Now, later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at an inside page from The Sun and the front page as well of Metro. And it says this: Trump, the trial's beginning, of course. 34 raps, it says, the ex-president is facing. The trial is an assault on America, according to Donald Trump. Front page of the Metro as well, Trump's historic criminal trial. This is an outrage, ex-president's fury, as he appears in court. And, of course, he is back in the dock.
He returned to a New York court this afternoon, accused of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment made to porn star Stormy Daniels. As the case opened in New York this afternoon, Mr. Trump once again slammed it as a witch hunt, which shouldn't be allowed to happen. It's one of four legal battles being faced by the man who is the current presidential election favourite. But it's already going wrong for the prosecution. Joining me now is Chairman of Republican Overseas UK. It is, of course, Greg Swenson. Greg, very good evening to you.
Good to be here, Mike.
Welcome to the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. I mean, Donald Trump remains box office wherever he goes, right? He arrives in his motorcade, there's crowds outside, there's people demonstrating, there's people imitating him, there's a couple of Trump impersonators. The case hasn't, as far as I understand it, really got going yet. We've had the judge telling him that he's not allowed to speak, that he's not allowed to miss any of the hearings, that if he does so, an arrest warrant may be issued for him. But they're still going through the process of trying to find some impartial jurors, I understand. Yeah,
good luck with that. It would be really difficult in New York.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, it's a really hostile jury pool in New York. 88% of the jury pool voted for Biden. But it's not just that they voted for Biden. They are rabid anti-Trumpers.
Right.
Trump derangement syndrome was born in Manhattan.
Yeah.
If this trial was in Staten Island, he would win.
He would be fine.
He'd be
well,
fine.
This is it. I was saying this last week when I went over to America just over Easter break, and I was in Manhattan very, very short time, but in Connecticut, which you wouldn't really regard as one of the great Republican states necessarily.
No.
Everywhere I went, there were Trump banners, there were Trump flags,
sure.
There were Trump bumper stickers. I didn't see any for Biden.
Once you leave southwestern Connecticut, Fairfield County, where, you know, Greenwich and other uppity kind of lakefront liberal towns are, once you get out of there, it's a red state.
Yeah.
Same with Massachusetts and New York. Once you get out of the cities, the urban centers, and the sort of limousine liberal sections, which I would argue, you know, southwest or Fairfield County is, you know, it's a red state. It's very pro-Trump.
Right.
And so I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. And what about the fact that it could be that they won't find a jury? Because, you know, if you genuinely ask anyone, I would have thought, even the most sort of disenfranchised American, have you got a view of Donald Trump? You're going to have one, aren't you?
Right, yeah. It's pretty obscene to have this trial in Manhattan. He will not get a fair trial. He will not have a jury of his peers. He's going to have a jury of people that hate him. Okay, so I think there's a good chance that he gets a conviction here, even though on a legal basis, it's a complete sham. I mean, it's weak and untested legal premises.
Right.
It's the worst of all the four indictments, right? Which is good for Trump that the worst case is
goes
coming
first. Yeah.
But he still could get a conviction because of the hostile jury pool.
But it'll
be overturned on appeal.
Well, yeah, but if in fact his lawyers are as good as I would imagine they are, they may say, well, it's impossible to actually field a jury at all. I don't know if there's any legal precedent. I mean, you may not know the answer to this.
Yeah.
But has there ever been a case where they couldn't find enough people to form a jury?
I don't know, but I can speculate that it's going to be really difficult in Manhattan. Same thing in Washington, D.C. So if this case was anywhere else, he'd be fine. Or anywhere but San Francisco, New York, Chicago, and Washington. But also, It just shows you how obscene the case is that they have to do it in New York. The predecessor of Alvin Bragg, Cyrus Vance Jr., chose not to prosecute.
Yeah.
This case is really a stretch, and even Alvin Bragg didn't want to do it, and was pressured by the sort of woke progressive cult in the New York DA's office.
Right. I mean, it says here that jury selection could take up to a fortnight. I mean, how does this affect his ability to campaign? I mean, one of the things that's fortunate, I guess, for him, I understand this is true, is that as long as he's campaigning to be president, all of his legal fees are payable by the campaign contributions that are made to him. So he doesn't have to worry about how much it's going to cost.
That's right. And you can make a pretty good argument for that.
Yeah.
The only reason he's being indicted and accused of these crimes or supposed crimes is because he's running for president.
Right.
So it truly is a campaign expense, if you want to argue that. I mean, I'm not suggesting that everyone who donates to the campaign wants it going to lawyers, but the fact is, if he wasn't running for president, these cases would not exist.
Yeah. You could also argue, I suppose, that him sitting in a courtroom on camera, on television every single day is about the best campaign he could ever have.
And he's already turned it into a campaign. You know, on one hand, they're keeping him from campaigning by keeping him in the courtroom. But on the other hand, today was a great campaign event for him. And remember, this is the ultimate election interference. This all the alleged crimes occurred 8 years ago. They didn't think to indict him on any of this stuff until he declared he was running again.
Yes.
So that's what's important to keep in mind.
Right.
And same with the other three indictments. You know, no one was bothering with any of this.
And also listening.
And then when he announced he was running, they
and listening to various opinions on all of this, I mean, it seems to come down to most people's view that, okay, even if he did do what they're alleging that he did, it's not actually illegal.
No.
So how is it a crime?
It's not a crime. In fact, falsifying business records in the state of New York is a misdemeanor, okay?
Yeah.
It's like speeding ticket.
Right.
Okay, you shouldn't do it, but it's not a big deal.
Right.
They turned that into a felony.
Mm.
And so the felony had 5 years of statute of limitations, and then they extended it 1 year because of the COVID lockdown.
Right.
So it really is a stretch.
Yeah.
And making it a felony, that in itself was a real stretch because it's just not. And by the way, it's coming from Alvin Bragg, who's famous for reducing felony crime
yes.
from violent criminals to misdemeanors.
Right.
So you could have an armed robbery, and now it's a misdemeanor and you pay $100.
And interestingly, we're reminded more than ever, of course, about what Trump's presidency was like, because during the time when Trump was in and he opted out of that ridiculous agreement with Iran that Barack Obama started,
JCPOA,
right? Iran was not in a position to do what they've just done.
Absolutely.
And they would never have done it.
Absolutely.
And people are now saying that many of the weapons that they have used were funded by Joe Biden when he released all of the funds to them.
They really are. And so by stopping the enforcement of the embargo on Iran, they went from 1 million barrels a day to 4 million barrels a day. That's turned into $60 billion.
Right.
And by the way, Biden, of course, attacked the U.S. energy sector, which elevated oil prices, right?
Yeah.
He cut back on production and made it really difficult for the U.S. to produce. So, you know, the U.S. had become the swing price for oil.
Right.
So not only did he enable the Iranians, the mullahs, to sell more oil, 1 million to 4 million barrels a day, but he also elevated the prices. Who did that benefit? The mullahs, Putin, and Venezuela.
Yeah.
And at the expense of the American taxpayer, the American voter, as well as the rest of the world, like the UK and the rest of Europe, that has to pay more for energy.
Yes.
It's
and
crazy.
I've read some great stuff over the last couple of days as well, particularly in the US, about how that whole kind of idea of Barack Obama's to firstly agree to give them credit as the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think he was the first American president to call them by that particular name.
Yeah.
Gave them kind of, you know, succor and comfort, gave them encouragement to join the world kind of view of everything. And, of course, they're never going to do that.
No,
so all of this stems all the way back to Barack Obama, doesn't it?
It really does. And the JCPOA was a complete disaster.
Yeah.
We could thank Obama and John Kerry for that. They didn't even bring it to the Senate. So it was never an actual treaty signed by the U.S.
Right.
because the Senate would never have gone for that. So this was a disaster. Trump backed away from it on day one and dropped out of the JCPOA. Biden, of course, day one, tried to get back into it, started appeasing the Iranians, appeasing the mullahs. He took the Houthis off the terrorist list.
And now
he stopped Keystone Pipeline in America, but he flipped the switch back on for Nord Stream 2. He made all these really disastrous mistakes that had a great effect on geopolitics.
Yeah, and effectively destabilized the Middle East because
really,
it gave Iran kind of proxy permission to continue to fund Hamas and Hezbollah, who, as I was saying earlier to our war correspondent over there in the Middle East, have been firing weapons into Israel ever since.
That's right.
It's not just this weekend.
And so the United States is now funding both sides of the conflict in Israel because we're essentially funding, or Biden is funding Iran and the mullahs. He's also funding indirectly the Russians by elevating oil prices. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, went to Moscow before the Ukraine invasion and begged Putin to pump more oil to bring prices down.
Right.
I mean, it's just obscene. And now Iran is sending drones to Russia
that are
indirectly funded by the United States.
And do you think any of that sort of foreign policy stuff will play into the election in November?
Absolutely, Mike. It's foreign policy doesn't typically rank in terms of, you know, voter issues. This year it does. Every 20 years or so, in 84 with Reagan and the Cold War, 2004 with George W., in spite of his mistakes, foreign policy was a big deal in 2004.
Right.
It was right after 9/11.
Right.
So every 20 years or so it happens. It's happening this year. It's gone from 20% to 40% in terms of how it ranks as a top issue.
Right.
The border is number one.
Right.
Inflation is number two. and foreign politics number three. All those problems were caused by Joe Biden. Mm. So this isn't Jimmy Carter that who inherited a lot of bad stuff. He inherited inflation for sure. I'm not sure you can blame Jimmy Carter for the things that happened in, you know, the Russians invading Afghanistan or the Islamic revolution in Iran. But Biden has caused all these things. To compare him to Jimmy Carter, I think, is an insult to Jimmy Carter.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. Biden is still, I think, going to be one of the worst presidents in the history of the United States of America. Greg Swenson from Republicans.
Good to be here, Mike.
Thank you very much. Indeed. We're going to look now at some live pictures from New York. We're over there watching Donald Trump at the trial. He's inside that building. Obviously, he's the first former US president to stand trial in a criminal case, although it looks as though it's going to take them at least 2 weeks, possibly longer, to find any number of people who can actually be jurors in the case. Because, of course, to be a juror, you must be impartial. And I don't think you can find anybody in New York City who's on a jury pool who could ever say, oh, no, I don't have an opinion about Donald Trump. I don't really know who he is. Can't really imagine that conversation, can you? So this is going to run and run. It's on the front pages of the papers. We'll be looking at those a little bit later on. Trial in New York is an assault on America, so says The Sun. And it really is quite astonishing what is going on there and really quite ridiculous because, as I say, what this means is that Donald Trump has got free publicity for the best campaign he could ever have run, backed by the Democrats, backed by the people who have given him campaign contributions. You know, if I was him, I'd be sitting there feeling quite happy about it all, to be honest. But now, let's go on to royal news, because Prince Harry has once again lost his legal bid following the removal of his government-funded security. The Duke of Sussex attempted to challenge a decision from the Home Office not to let him hire armed police bodyguards when he visits the UK. Cue the tiny violin. Also, it's cost him about £1 million, so cue Meghan giving him a bit of a hard time. I think he's going to have a thick ear when he gets back to Montecito tonight because he's going to have to tell her, I've lost another £1 million, darling. With me now is Rafe Heidel-Mankiw, historian and broadcaster. Welcome back, Rafe. This man seems to be addicted to lawfare, if we want to invest in that new word that Donald Trump invented. He can't stop suing people.
Well, I said before, he's got an addictive personality, clearly, because it does extend also to these law cases. Mm. Now, he's lost this right of appeal, but it's not the final right of appeal. So he can still appeal this one more time.
Right.
So
is he going to just keep going?
Well, it's only got one more stage to go.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's remind ourselves here, this is the first time in history that a member of the royal family has taken his father's government to court. Quite unprecedented.
Yes.
But in denying the appeal, it reinforces the original opinion, which was essentially that if you are not a working royal, why should the British taxpayer pay for your security?
Yes.
Prince Andrew doesn't have security. He's not a working royal.
Right.
We've seen, you know, with Prince William able to walk the streets of London and England perfectly fine without any sort of attacks on him. The idea that Prince Harry is somehow a special case. I mean, you remember the absurd scene during the coronation where you had the presidents of France and the lady and the First Lady of America coming over, and Prince Harry wanted his own private security detail.
Yeah.
If the presidents of France and the First Lady are fine with the arrangements we have here, I don't see why he needs to have special arrangements.
But I think you've hit the nail on the head, because I think what Harry really wants is special treatment, ends. He just wants special treatment in every situation that he's in. Because at the end of the day, here's a guy who feels that, you know, he is somehow born into some right that he should be treated differently to everybody else. And that comes through in everything that he's written, and we'll come to the stuff he wrote about in Spare in a moment. But, you know, when he first started the lawsuit, he said he didn't feel safe coming to Britain, that he sort of tried to invoke the unfortunate death of his mother as some kind of reason why he feared the public and why he feared being assassinated or whatever it was. And he said he didn't feel safe bringing his children here. But since he made those claims, he's been here loads of times.
He's been here loads of times, but also it's the exaggeration about the threat that he feels. You know, just because that the press surround you, as they did at when he was at an event in Kew Gardens, perfectly normal media scrum, somehow this became a security threat.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, if you are a celebrity, if you're a member of the royal family, you have to expect these sorts of things. These paparazzi aren't armed with machine guns or anything like that.
You know?
He does have a perfectly competent security detail. Yeah. They just aren't armed.
Right.
They're perfectly qualified to deal with that sort of a situation.
He also goes out in places like the United States of America, far more dangerous, I would say, where you're likely to have far more harm put upon you than you are in this country, because it's a place where something like 40,000 people are shot dead every single year, you know. And so it seems remarkable, doesn't it? But so you think he's going to continue to the bitter end with this particular thing?
Oh, yes. I mean, look, he's had so many court cases on the go, and we've just had in America, we've just, of course, had this issue about his US visa.
Yes, I was coming on to that, yeah.
All right, yes. Well, so we just had the American ambassador to this country has basically said that whatever happens, he won't be deported by the Biden administration,
yes.
Which is an extraordinary intervention.
Isn't it just?
Into a court case by the federal government when actually these issues haven't been resolved. The Heritage Foundation, who are the right-wing organisation that are bringing this law case to have Harry's visa application made public,
yes.
Say that the fact that the ambassador has now said this makes it even more important that we actually get to know
right.
here. Because he said that he likes to talk about himself as being very important. The whole reason of his book Spare was to say, well, my brother was privileged.
Yes.
I wasn't privileged.
But
I was so hard done
right.
by. But if we now get to see that actually the government knew that he took drugs... Mm. And let him in anyway.
Right.
Well, that's privilege there, is it
yes,
not?
Yes, it is.
Differently. Or secondly, now we have them saying, well, whatever happens, he's never going to leave the
right.
country. Whereas any of us, if we were found right. to have lied on our application, we'd be booted out immediately.
Indeed, and certain
this
people...
This guy is a complete beneficiary of privilege.
Yeah, and other people, I don't want to say their names because I'm not absolutely sure of them, have been refused entry to the US in the past because of previous... I think Nigella Lawson...
Nigella Lawson was stopped boarding a plane.
Because she wasn't allowed to get on a plane because she'd spoken previously about how she had occasionally used cocaine. I mean, his book, Spare, is full of him talking about magic mushrooms, smoking marijuana, which is not illegal in California, taking other drugs, cocaine, I think he mentions. You know, there's no question that he... claimed that he was so unhappy and so mentally mixed up that he took the drugs to make himself feel better. So if he has made all of that up, that makes him an even more desperately strange character, doesn't
it? It's a no-win situation. Either you lied on your application form, in which case, you know, you're a liar, or you lied in Spare, in which case you're a liar.
You
made money out of it. So which of these is? There's no way out of it for him. And actually, increasingly, there's no way of the government, either the US government, saving face here either.
Right.
In both of their cases, it seems as if they're both basically on a hiding to embarrassment.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a very strange place that he finds himself in, isn't it? Where he's sort of been kind of debanked, if you like, for want of a better word, in America. You know, they're no longer the people that that they thought they were going to be. They don't seem to... I see that at the weekend he was at playing polo and, of course, Meghan managed to make her way onto the winner's sort of podium and push everybody else out of the way while she stood there kissing him and holding the cup that he'd won. But there was also quite a funny video of him falling off the horse, which people I know who know about horses say, well, he should never have fallen off that horse. If he's a pretty good horseman, that shouldn't have happened. But playing polo is hardly going to feed into their sort of amazing world of helping the underprivileged to sort of be given a helping hand.
It's literally called the sport of kings,
yeah,
right? This is a man who wants to distance himself from the monarchy completely.
Yeah.
And yet, yeah, so I mean, this is the most elitist, the most exclusive and expensive sport you can play
right.
on land. And, you know, it's completely runs contrary to this whole idea that he's one of the people singing Kumbaya while having his chai latte.
Yes.
But what you have to remember here now is that in America, it's really exclusively now the Meghan show.
Yes.
Meghan has now got this Netflix deal to do a show about, you know, cooking and gardening.
Gardening,
and entertaining,
yeah.
And friendship.
Friendship, I'm looking forward to that one.
No mention of family, of course, because family's not her strong point.
Well, her family's at the moment, I think her brother... has been sort of hauled over the coals for making fun of her. And apparently, you're not allowed to do that anymore. So apparently, YouTube have given him some kind of warning because he's been issuing what have been described to me as vile messages to her. But, I mean, he's her brother. He's entitled to do it, isn't he?
Well, it's a bit of a Les Dawson scene. We know Sissy and Ada's, how he looks.
Right.
But, yes, Meghan actually has now got everything that she wanted out of this relationship. She married Harry.
I was just showing off my new bump that I bought used on eBay out of Montecito.
Yeah, deary me. And this is her giving him the cup, which I was describing earlier, whereas at some point it's all... And people have been describing her dress for this as particularly inappropriate as well.
But the point I'm trying to make here is that everything that Meghan did got her to this point. She wanted to marry Harry to advance herself as an international star. She's using that to promote her lifestyle brand. And I think these new Netflix shows work very well with what she's done in terms of her American Riviera Orchard branding.
Yeah.
But poor Harry doesn't have any discernible skills.
No.
There's no commercial abilities that he's got. Yeah. He can be a prince, he can be a soldier, he can play polo.
Yeah.
Well, Netflix have done the prince thing with the Harry and Meghan documentary. They've done the soldier bit with Invictus, and now they're doing polo with this show here. But beyond that, there's nothing that he has left.
No.
That's why he's been, you know, I think, saying, well, I would be happy to come back to England and help out the royal family in their time of need.
Right.
Because all that he knows to do is be a royal. I mean, this is the thing.
Well, I suppose if Donald Trump does win the presidential election in November, he may help him out with that particular wish because he could deport him.
Yes, will the British people take him back? This is what...
Well, that's a very interesting point. I mean, whenever I've done any kind of sort of polling of people who watch this show and previous shows in the previous years, even before he was so sort of reviled, people were like, no, we don't want him back. I mean, I once did a show where I said that he should be stripped of his British citizenship because of the harm that he's trying to do to the royal family, who are, after all, the heads of state of this country. And almost everybody agreed with me. They just don't want to see him.
Harry, what have you done, you know?
Because
you can really quite see in the future in a situation perhaps where, if he does want to come back to this country because he seems quite unhappy and rudderless in America.
Yeah.
He's got no purpose. I mean, they're trying to create, essentially, in America, a mini version of of the royal court in Britain.
Yeah.
Their website's more regal now.
Ridiculous.
They're calling their kids prince and princesses because all he knows to do is to cut a few ribbons, read a pre-scripted speech, and that's about it.
And the point about British royal family to Americans is that they like it because it's British. They don't like it because you live in California and because one of you is American. That's not what they like about the royal family. They like British royal family because they think it's a bit quirky, a bit weird. They live in these big, drafty sort of castles. You know, they've got plenty of money, but they look like they got dressed, you know, in the dark. You know, that's kind of what they like.
Well, and it requires prestige. You know, Charles de Gaulle once said, prestige cannot survive without mystery, for one reveres little what one knows well.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, we know Harry and Meghan far too well now.
More than I ever wished to know.
Exactly, even his todger.
Yes.
So once you know that amount of information, as you put in his book Spare, it's very hard for people to look up to an institution or to a couple like that as being royal. They've just entered the world of LA celebrity stardom, which is a very vacuous and superficial world to inhabit, unfortunately.
Perfect for them.
Perhaps been very, very suitable.
Perfect for them. Rafe, thank you very much indeed. Rafe Hyland-Mancu there. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Aging hospitals crumble and an all-round social media ban for under 16s. See you after this. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, you remember West Ham player Kurt Zouma, who a couple of years ago faced national derision for abusing his cat on social media. He kicked it. Now a squad of West Ham fans on a stag do have taken to a creative reimagining of those scenes. Have a look at this. You'll see, actually, it's sort of slightly gone. Watch it from the beginning. You can see that that's the Kurt Zouma thing that the fans were doing there. But let's start from the beginning, because that's the bit I really need to see. There he goes. So somebody dressed as a cat, and then the rest of them running through the town. Now, I think that's a great idea. I think it's funny, creative, different. And I've got the panel back with me, of course. Madeline Grant, Lord Dosworth, Andrew Eborn. You're always looking. So you didn't get it that time.
I don't know. It's normally the camera four.
Normally,
that's what they
yeah,
that,
see, you
that's
get
what
it.
They say. Camera
there you
four.
Go.
There
Never
you
mind.
Go.
We'll do it later. The fact remains. I mean, I hate stag do's normally. I don't like going on them. I don't like sort of going to say cities where there's loads of them. Hen do's and things. For God's sake. but that is imaginative. I quite like that. Ridiculously, people have said it's cruel. Because, of course, it's reminding everyone that he kicked his cat.
Well, I think so.
Come on.
I mean, I know. It's not like me to be the wet blanket.
You're now going to be in favour of banning people running around dressed as cats
ban
in
it,
West Ham players.
Make it illegal. In fact, isn't it already arguably a hate crime in Scotland?
In Scotland.
You wouldn't be allowed to do that.
Yeah. No, you probably wouldn't be allowed to do that in Scotland. It's interesting you say that, actually, because if a footballer did kick a cat in Scotland, would that be a hate crime?
It isn't. Well, no, because it's not one of the protected categories, and I think that's the
category.
See what I did there?
Very good. You didn't even know you were doing it.
The perfect defence would be good.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Now, the other thing I want to tell you about is an octopus. There's a great story which I found today. A boy has ended up with a lot more octopus than he planned. His parents decided to give him, for his birthday, I think, a pet octopus. Now, he may have a view on that, because I'm not sure it's a great idea for a pet. But unbeknownst to them, apparently, it was pregnant, this octopus. And there's now 50 of them roaming about.
Amazing.
And look at that. And they are incredible creatures, octopi, wow. Say?
Octopies or octopuses?
Octopi.
Octopodes, if you want octopodes. To be
really... Is it octopodes?
Yeah, no, they're all valid, all are valid.
OK.
I remember this on Countdown many years ago.
Oh, right, OK. Yeah. Well, I find them fascinating creatures because I once saw one swimming, and they swim in a way which you cannot really describe, but it's almost like they sort of pull all of their tentacles in and then push them out as they move, and they look amazing. Mm. And one of the other things that they do is if they land on any kind of rock or what, any kind of surface, they can camouflage themselves as that surface. So I was told if they landed on a chessboard, they would actually look like a black and white chessboard. They are, it's a pretty amazing skill.
It is pretty amazing.
Imagine if you could do that as a human.
I would,
you know,
love
you
it.
Could stand so, on the tube, you would just sort of meld into the background of the platform.
They also have, I think it's 3 hearts, don't they? And blue blood.
Well, I thought it was about 8 hearts, but I could be wrong about
it. They have tentacles.
They've got 8 tentacles.
Yes, exactly.
They've certainly got more than, one heart.
I think Mike knew that it was 8 tentacles.
Yeah, I did know that. Yeah, that's the octo bit.
They've got a serious rehoming problem, haven't they? Because if you have a litter of puppies unexpectedly,
you have a 10 or 12.
You can have a challenge getting rid of a litter of puppies or kittens, but 50 octopi, what are they going to do?
Yes.
I mean, one octopus, that's an unusual pet.
It is.
How are you going to find another 50? Well,
they rather hoped in the story, they hoped it was a male. They thought they had a male octopus.
Did they?
They
don't know much about octopus, by the sounds of it, these people. Yes. So they thought it was a male, and then they didn't know it was a female, and now it's pregnant. And
yeah, extraordinary.
I presume they'll have to let them all back into the wild, don't they?
Or have a big sushi party.
Oh, yes. No, you can't eat them.
I wonder if what kind of octopus this was. You know, was it a sort of run-of-the-mill octopus that you could just release into the water, or would it need a particular kind of water or a particular climate?
That's
you
a good question.
Down the toilet, that's what people do with unwanted goldfish.
That's a terrible idea.
No.
I don't mean
Well, I mean, they can get quite big as well. I mean, you get one down the toilet. But I once tried to cook one, because we've all eaten them. And some people don't eat them anymore.
Yummy.
In fact, my daughter, who dives a lot now and sees all kinds of fish in the water, doesn't eat them anymore because they're so intelligent that she thinks it would be a bad idea. So she just eats stupid fish.
Are we allowed? Is squid also off limits? Because that
well,
be quite
squid, I think, are not quite as clever.
No,
I don't think. But, you know, squid are lovely as well. But I once bought it at Borough Market, and I thought I'm going to just try cooking this octopus. And I didn't really know what I was doing. But somebody said what you have to do before you fry it, chop it up, is you have to sort of tenderize it. So you have to put it in a pot with boiling water. And I put it in this pot for boiling water, went outside into the garden, came back in, and the thing had expanded literally to about 10 times the size. And it was like something out of, you know, Quatermass.
Sci-fi.
The creature from the Black Lagoon. It was like climbing out of the pot. I mean, it was dead, obviously, but it was huge.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think whatever I did, I shouldn't have done it for that long. so I've never tried it again since.
Was it tender?
Well, it sort of didn't really taste the way I expected it to.
Oh, yeah.
I think I overcooked it.
But that's impressive. I mean, that's really thinking outside the box in a culinary way.
I just thought I'd try, because, I mean, it's all very well buying.
Did it make you think maybe next time I'll just do a lasagna?
Yes, and I'll just stick to leaving octopus. I'll just eat it in restaurants.
Certain places, they eat the little ones live, don't they, in certain countries as well? Yes.
I'm not keen on live
eating. Good old
Japan.
Yeah. Yes, well, it's sushi, exactly. They have a number of things. It's like strange things like fugu fish, which will kill you if you don't do it in the proper way.
Yeah, I'm not interested in eating things that can kill me. Definitely not. You get paid very well if you're a fugu chef.
Absolutely.
Apparently, you know, because you have to cut out the bile duct or whatever it is.
Yes.
Fascinating. Anyway, there we are. That's Animal Corner for you on the Independent Republic. Should we talk about social media could be banned for under 16s to protect them? How is this going to work? If at all.
Well, it's bizarre, isn't it? It came out as the tragic murder of Brianna Jai.
Right.
Mm. Her mother campaigned for this.
Yeah.
There are phones, which means that they are fairly basic phones that youngsters can have for just safety, can't have any of the apps. A lot of the app companies are now turning around and saying they're lowering the age to 13 as opposed to that sort of side. But it wouldn't have actually dealt with the mischief, because what happened to the horrible, horrible murder was actually about the dark web. It wasn't about these apps and social media and so on and so forth. It was about material which was found on the dark web as a result of it.
Right.
But social media companies need to take responsibility for this content. Mm. That's been the big push at the moment. And they're being fined up to about 10% of their annual turnover, gross turnover, which goes into billions.
But has that happened yet?
Well, this is what you need to do. You need to make examples of that sort of stuff to deal with the terrible things that have been happening.
A high-profile murder, and also there have been suicides as well linked to social media. These are high-profile events which sort of justify these kinds of laws. But I actually think there's a panoply of good reasons to prevent young people using social media.
Yeah.
over half of 8 to 10-year-olds have got smartphones. Mm. A considerable percentage of toddlers do. And in this country...
Yeah. That's crazy, isn't it?
In this country, British children who have smartphones are spending over 2 hours a day on TikTok.
Yeah.
I mean, I think instead of asking whether we should ban smartphones and social media for young people, why don't we just flip this around? What are they gaining from it? And you're not going to find many good answers. So a smartphone is great. It's a brain in your pocket. The world's at your fingertips. But there are so many studies that unequivocally link smartphone use with deleterious effects on your memory, your learning, all kinds of cognitive abilities. Of course, are these other links to social media bullying and, you know, unpleasant content we don't want young people to see, such as pornography, violence, really unpalatable stuff on the dark web. But I think you just need to flip it around. What are they benefiting from social media? And the answer is probably nothing. Mm. They'd be better off forming real-life connections with young people. So I'm really here for it. I'm here for banning social media and smartphones for under 16s.
Right, yeah, but how would you, though? Because you're effectively saying you're going to stop somebody from doing something. A bit like the vaping ban, a bit like the smoking ban, a bit like the drinking ban. Yeah. You know, teenagers, as you know better than anyone, as I do, will find a way to look at things.
Oh, I know. And you can't stop people doing it in their own homes, unless your homes are used to
You could say that about, you know, 15-year-olds getting hold of booze or cigarettes. Right. I'm not saying it's equally... Although I think Laura's right. I mean, it's... What are these parents thinking? Any young child under, like, I don't know, 8 is being given their own smartphone. I mean, what child needs a smartphone?
I think in my household, but I also we said when they go to secondary school, then that's maybe when they need.
You need certain things for safety. If people are travelling by themselves on the tube and the bus, you need to make sure that... But also, it's not...
I didn't have a smartphone on public transport when I was going to...
I guess there were safer days, though,
I know you don't think I'm old enough. Well, I really am, and I didn't have a smartphone for travelling to school.
It also depends on the content, because some of the content that you can get is fantastic for education, for improving mental ability and so on and so forth. It does depend on the content. Some of it is rubbish and we absolutely have to prevent the horrific content that you get. But a lot of that it's not just somebody else's responsibility, it's the parents together with the schools, together with society as a whole. And if you don't have a free market, then you're going to get a black market. And you work on that sort of premise that basically peer pressure, if you're the one kid in school who hasn't got a smartphone...
Yeah, but if they're banned... Then loads of kids won't have them. So
they'll find a way around it.
Of course, parents can't find a way around it.
Some kids will find a way around it, but overall, you would have fewer kids using it. And that's
this is like the argument they make, though, isn't it, for not legalising marijuana? Because as long as it's illegal, people have to make that decision to break the law in order to buy it, and so fewer of them will.
Yeah.
And if you make it legal, then more of them will feel less inhibited, if you like.
Yeah.
But equally, I would say that there's... and I take your point, Laura, as well, about the, the horrific nature of that particular murder. There've always been those horrible kinds of events. The Bulger killings, there was no social media, then everybody blamed... What was it?
Chucky, the movie. That's
Chucky.
Right.
Yeah, really? Child's Play.
Yeah, Child's Play, Chucky,
And unfortunately, there are just some very horrible people.
Psychopaths
could be influenced by any form of media. Yeah. These high-profile events are what get us talking about these bans and rules and laws, but actually there's just so many other reasons why kids shouldn't be on smartphones for... hours a day.
No, I get that.
I think it's something like 4 hours a day on average.
Having it down to the discretion of parents alone, and I agree that we can't create a perfect world, but right now the children who come from the most privileged backgrounds, you know, like the children of the tech CEOs, they're not given iPads, they're not given iPhones, they're given books, and they're told to go outside and play. I mean, it's a sort of luxury belief type thing.
Yes.
Where people say one thing, evangelise one thing publicly, and then in private do something completely different.
Yeah. Steve Jobs, famous example, exactly. His kids didn't have Apple products.
Exactly.
And make no mistake, these tech platforms know exactly what they're doing. You know, there was leaked data from Meta, from Facebook and Instagram a few years ago, which said that they knew that the use of Instagram and Facebook was leading to body image anxiety and mental health disorders in young people. They knew it. They didn't plan to release that. That was leaked. So they're very aware of how unhealthy their platforms are for young people, while at the same time making them addictive and sticky.
And it's certainly made a big difference in the whole trans area, hasn't it? Because there's never been more sort of enthusiasm for some of the weird practices that we've seen.
Rapid onset gender dysphoria.
Oh, hang on. We've got Donald Trump apparently emerging from court. We could go live to it. Let's have a listen, shall we?
Amazing things happen today. As you know, my son is graduating from high school, and it looks like the judge will not let me go to the graduation of my son, who's worked very, very hard. He's a great student. He's very proud of the fact that he did so well. I was looking forward for years to have graduation with his mother and father there, and it looks like the judge isn't going to allow me to escape this scam. It's a scam trial. If you read all of the legal pundits, all of the legal scholars today, there's not one that I see that said this is a case that should be brought or tried. It's a scam. It's a political witch hunt. It continues, and it continues forever. And we're not going to be given a fair trial. It's a very, very sad thing. In addition, as you know, next Thursday, we're before the United States Supreme Court at a very big hearing on immunity. And this is something that we've been waiting for a long time. And the judge, of course, is not going to allow us. He's a very conflicted judge. And he's not going to allow us to go to that. He won't allow me to leave here for a half a day, go to D.C. and go before the United States Supreme Court because he thinks he's superior, I guess, to the Supreme Court. We've got a real problem with this judge. We have a real problem with a lot of things having to do with this trial, including the D.A., because you go right outside and people are being mugged and killed all day long, and he's sitting here all day with about 10 or 12 prosecutors over nothing, over nothing, over what people say shouldn't be a trial. So I just want to thank you very much, but that I can't go to my son's graduation, or that I can't go to the United States Supreme Court, that I'm not in Georgia or Florida or North Carolina campaigning like I should be, it's perfect for the radical left Democrats. That's exactly what they want. This is about election interference. That's all it's about. Thank you very much.
As I was saying to Greg Swenson earlier, this is the greatest campaign material he could ever possibly have, isn't it? He doesn't need to be campaigning in North Carolina. But for him to be able to come out and say he's banned from going to see his own son's graduation for such a ridiculous case, I think he's going to get even more sympathy, isn't he?
Absolutely. You're right, Mike. And the more they throw at him, the more his popularity increases.
How can they not see that?
Yeah.
It's like the mugshot.
Right.
Was there ever such a powerful
made
mugshot?
Made it into
what,
a...
He
made
t-shirts.
Yes.
He made $7 million in the first 24 hours or something.
He's had
he?
So much money, donated to his campaign as a result of all this.
Right.
It's such a home goal for the Democrats.
But I do feel sorry. The fact he can't go to his son's graduation...
That is awful, actually.
I do feel
genuinely
sorry.
Genuinely terrible.
Genuinely terrible.
Because you only have one of those.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you can only do certain things with your children. You can only do that right. Once, really.
And everybody's innocent until proven guilty, well, and I think that's the point. Whatever
right.
people's
Donald
views
Trump's
are...
Donald Trump's probably been to quite a few child's graduations in his time.
He may well have been, but he hasn't been to this one.
Not to this one.
Not to this
and
one.
Again, you know, it'll boost his ratings.
Of course
again.
It will.
Yeah.
But he will win. He will win the presidency.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. We must go, though, because we've got much more to do. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Gender Madness is one of the worst-performing NHS trusts, unveils its multi-gender banners. And all the top stories from tomorrow's papers as well. Stay exactly where you are. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
Have you managed to get a doctor's appointment lately? Have you been able to extract some kind of referral to a specialist? Or indeed, have you secured a hospital bed from where your long-awaited operation can finally take place? If you're a patient rocking around inside the NHS system, you will know just how difficult all of the above is to get. Appointments and operations are amongst the hardest things to obtain in 2024 as waiting lists get longer and longer, while the numbers of people in the queue go up and up. Well, at the Royal Stoke Hospital, they've come up with a plan. It might not get you into the system any quicker, it definitely won't speed up your treatment or ensure that you get the best of the best healthcare while you're in there, but it will mean that everyone is welcome. That's right. They've decided to install a banner at hospital reception. And it's not just any banner. It's there to say, everyone is welcome here, including anyone from a multitude of genders. 21, to be precise. The banner also includes loads of different flags. Not of any countries, mind you, but of all the different and various sexualities they recognise, including the rainbow, progress, which is a new one on me, bisexual, transgender, non-binary, pansexual, genderqueer, gay men... and lesbians. There's also a few flags you might not have heard of. Polysexual, that's attracted to more than one gender. Agender, rejecting gender identity, gender fluid, gender identity and expression changes over time, demisexual, only feels sexual attraction once an emotional bond has been formed, and my personal favourite, new troys, or new trois, meaning you identify as neither a man or a woman and you have no gender at all. Just 2 years ago, the University Hospitals of North Midlands NHS Trust was one of the worst performing in the country. It didn't even make the top 100 out of 120 trusts for overall performance. And along with other NHS hospitals all over the country, patients are being offered a choice of 159 religions, 12 genders and 10 sexual preferences on a form before they even enter the place for any kind of procedure. Call me old-fashioned, but I don't think people actually care about being seen by a doctor when they need one as to what religion they are. I don't think being cared for by a nurse while they're there and having a decent surgeon to operate on them to make them any better. I'm pretty certain most patients won't care what religion the person next to them is or whether they are genderqueer or demi-romantic. And no, that's nothing to do with Demi Moore. Here's another thing. Why limit the numbers? Some schools are teaching that there are 72 different genders and sexualities, so where did they get 21 from? And if you want to know why the NHS isn't fit for purpose, you need look no further than the Royal Stoke Hospital. Absolutely ridiculous state of affairs, but that is the World of Woke.
The World of Woke.
The panel is still here with me. I mean, I don't know what to say about all of that, really.
Do you know, I disagree with you, and not often, but I actually do care. I do want to know if the nurse or the doctor treating me as demi-romantic, because frankly, I don't want to be under their care if they are. Because
but would you not have to look it up first?
No, though? I'd be really suspicious about how their mind works if that's how they're thinking.
Well, at least there's no hidden gender.
It's quasi-religious.
Yeah, but surely if you go to a hospital,
it's a psychic epidemic.
Yeah, but
it's
if you
madness.
Go to a hospital, you shouldn't have to worry about the person that's treating you. Yeah. Or the person who's the nurse, or, you know, because they should be doing their job. They shouldn't have their job altered by their religion or by their sexuality.
They don't want to know what their pronouns are. None of that. No. Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there has been this, you know, absolute explosion in all the different gender identities and sexualities, etc. But I think it also taps into this idea that people have to kind of bring their whole self to work and constantly talk about themselves. It's identitarian.
I must tell you what my sexual identity is. Why? I don't care.
It seeps into everything. You know, the pressure that's put on people in certain companies to have their pronouns and their email signature. Yeah. And if you were to say, no, I don't really want to take part in that, that would be considered a suspicious thing.
A microaggression, even.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Shall we talk about Nick Robinson? Nick Robinson's latest member of the BBC staff to get himself into hot water over interviewing someone about the Iranian situation and Israel. He basically came out and said on the Radio 4 Today programme that Israel had been murdering Israeli and Palestinian civilians, and he later had to issue a correction.
He said murdered tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, that wasn't reflecting the views of the BBC, it wasn't even reflecting my own views, they're just words that I said. It was a strange apology. I mean, the thing is, people have been accepting Hamas's released figures on casualties blindly.
Yeah.
And that in itself is a real sign of, you know, ideological bias. One might even call it Israelophobia or anti-Semitism. It's odd to just take the word of murdering baby killers and hostage takers as de facto. Mm. There was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania who analysed the casualty figures coming out of Hamas.
Yes.
It was reported in The Telegraph and maybe in Tablet, I think. And it was really fascinating reading. But he said basically because the figures were going up in a linear fashion...
Yeah.
Every day,
right.
And the percentage of women and children, which was 70%, same, it just couldn't be true. He pointed out the data inconsistencies.
Yes, I saw that.
So I think we've got very good grounds to suspect, for multiple reasons, that those figures aren't even correct.
Right.
So once again, the BBC is biased. But this bias is seeping through in our own government. I mean, in the light of Iran's attack on Israel, you know, this heinous attack of hundreds of weapons, including 110 ballistic weapons... Quite astonishingly, we had David Cameron saying, well, you know,
just
basically, take the win.
Yeah.
Israel should take the win. Mm. Now, the Middle East is a very tough neighbourhood.
Sure. Yeah.
And a line has been crossed. Iran has vowed forever to destroy Israel. And you could say it's what it's been doing through proxy enemies such as the Houthis, Hamas, Hezbollah. And now this is like a watershed moment. It has actually attacked Israel.
Yeah.
The idea that Israel should take the win and not be allowed to defend itself is just quite astonishing. Now, if we were attacked by hundreds of weapons and ballistic weapons, would we be retaliating?
And also, would we listen to other countries telling us just to leave it? Just don't do anything. Just leave it at that.
Although that's a bit of a bind that Israel finds itself in.
Yes.
Because should they not retaliate? Well, that will clearly embolden Iran.
Exactly.
However, should they retaliate too hard?
Yeah.
That may alienate the new international coalition that we saw on
because
display.
Because they've now got a bit of sympathy.
I mean, it's extraordinary to me that we saw, you know, Jordanian fighter planes defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Absolutely.
And that comes after those allies or... Maybe allies is too strong a word, but they have a shared interest in fighting Iran.
Well, there are a lot of people who believe that the whole Hamas movement was designed to blow away the Abraham Accords and the fact that Saudi Arabia were about to form a new sort of partnership.
Saudi Arabia was also involved in the defence.
Yes.
The UK, US, France, Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Mm. And Saudi Arabia have released their statements saying that, you know... the Iranian regime supports Hamas, they're acknowledged terrorists. I'm not sure that a retaliation... I mean, I'm no geopolitical expert here.
I'm not saying they shouldn't retaliate. I think a retaliation
carefully targeted at undermining Iran's military capabilities would be proportionate.
Yes.
And I don't think that would lose the sympathy of any of its allies.
But I do think we should, as people have emphasised, we should show restraint. And also, the media has been talking about not casualties this time, but how many weapons were fired. Actually, 99% of the weapons got destroyed. I think they probably knew that, so it's more a bark than a bite.
Well, there are different schools of thought on that.
It could be the preamble. I mean, let's not forget that Hezbollah, which is far closer geographically, is sitting
and
with
they were designed, cash. Yeah, and they could be designed to confuse
and
the system.
Iran has failed to destroy Israel.
Because we're going to be
Israel.
Out of here in a minute, so I just want to look at the front page of the Sun. Sorry. I know, we could carry this on in the bar afterwards.
Yes.
Return of TV talent show. Hasn't Britain's Got Talent had its day? I mean, do you think we could do with another portion of Britain's Got Talent?
People love reality shows. Water cooler moments, gathering around the TV. We were talking about the death of TV earlier. Mm.
Well, one of the great things of the weekend was Amanda Holden's row with... Mrs. Oswald.
Oswald, absolutely Oswald. Glorious.
Who basically tore a massive strip off her and said, honey, you're not in my league.
Yes.
It was really great.
What was this on?
This was on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to check it. It was really good.
Absolutely brilliant.
Really brilliant. Yeah, absolutely amazing. Anyway, we're out of time, I'm afraid. So thank you very much indeed to all of the panel. You've been watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I'll see you tomorrow at 8 o'clock.